From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I believe that within 15 to 50 years, we will have computers as smart as people are.
The answer is, your listeners have a chance to live to be 200 or 250 and stay healthy. The potential is for expanding the human lifespan indefinitely.
By the year 2050, I would expect us to be able to effectively regrow almost parts of the body to new order.
Certainly at the end of the next century, I think something like half-man, half-ape type creatures become possible.
Visions with physicist Michio Kaku, how science will revolutionize the 21st century. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate will all but bury a bill to overhaul the country's campaign financing system. In successive procedural votes, senators failed to halt debate on two competing proposals. That left a stalemate and prevented an up or down decision on the legislation itself. Senator Trent Lott of Mississippi, the majority leader and an all-out opponent of the bill, said the vote showed that there was, quote, no consensus on the issue, and then moved the Senate on to other business. Lott said he'd held up my end of the bargain by allowing 22 hours of debate on legislation. Supporters of the basic bill, mostly Democrats, accused Lott of burying it by rigging debate, barring any amendments other than his own, and then blocking a vote on that measure when Democrats and Republican defectors appeared ready to defeat it. Proponents vowed to continue a long-shot fight this week to keep the bill's faint hopes alive. In an expression of frustration with the White House, the Justice Department yesterday subpoenaed a top presidential lawyer to appear before a federal grand jury to explain why videotapes showing President Clinton with wealthy supporters at coffees and other events at the White House have been withheld for months. Lanny Brewer, the associate White House counsel in charge of investigations, will go before the grand jury on Wednesday. This according to the officials who spoke on condition of anonymity. One official said that other White House assistants might also receive subpoenas. The exasperation with the White House over the tapes also exploded in the Senate. Senator Fred Thompson, the chair of the committee investigating campaign finance practices, demanded that President Clinton take personal responsibility for the tardiness in turning over the tapes to investigators and for all the fundraising abuses in last year's election campaign. And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! A mission by a UN human rights expert to probe the U.S. capital punishment practices by interviewing death row prisoners has been denounced by the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee as an intentional insult to the United States and its legal system. Senator Jesse Helms, a Republican of North Carolina, aimed his ire at an ongoing visit by Bakary Ndiaye of Senegal, a UN Human Rights Commission special investigator on extrajudicial, summary, and arbitrary executions. In a letter sent Monday to Bill Richardson, U.S. ambassador at the United Nations, Helms called Ndiaye's mission an absurd UN charade and a perfect example of why the United Nations is looked upon with such disdain by the American people. Helms cited a report written by Ndiaye last year in which the investigator asserted that some U.S. death sentences result from proceedings, quote, which fall short of international guarantees for a fair trial. And the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee hearings on campaign finance abuses erupted yesterday into a heated round of accusations as Senator Fred Thompson again attacked President Clinton to step up to the plate and take responsibility for Democratic fundraising practices. The partisan attacks delayed the appearance of the day's star witness, former White House Deputy Chief of Staff Harold Ickes, a key figure in the investigation. 5 hours later, when Ickes finally testified, he forcefully defended the Democrats' 1996 fundraising operation in a prepared opening statement and told the committee that, quote, your complaint is with the law, not with us. We play by the rules. You and only you have the power to change the law and change the rules. There was no time left for Ickes to be questioned, and he was retold to return today. Cuba's Communist Party begins its first Congress in 6 years today. The three-day meeting, sandwiched around 30th anniversary of the death of the communist icon Che Guevara, is expected to ratify some changes in the composition of the 225-member Central Committee and the smaller Politburo, the subjects of perhaps the most curiosity to ordinary Cubans and to foreign diplomats and academic specialists. But all indications are that the party intends to hold the line on vital and vexing political and economic economic issues. The last party Congress was held in October 91, a time of severe economic dislocation and ideological uncertainty, coming as it did as the Soviet Union was collapsing. And the days of cell block light bulbs flickering at midnight candlelight vigils and literal 11th-hour appeals may be coming to an end. Arizona, Texas, and Virginia are abandoning midnight as the hour of death, opting to hold executions in the afternoon or the evening to reduce lost sleep for judges, overtime for guards, and added strain on victims. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor complained about an execution in Arizona last June that prompted the state to do away with putting inmates to death at midnight. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. With the approach of the next millennium, there is growing anticipation, anxiety, and curiosity about what the future will bring. Will the 21st century bring a Garden of Eden, a paradise of peace and plenty, an age of Aquarius? Or will it bring us the nightmare of 1984, the brave new world? Now, renowned scientist and best-selling author Dr. Michio Kaku has taken on these questions in a new book and radio documentary. Visions, as the new project is called, documents how scientists are making the technologies that will revolutionize the 21st century. Through interviews with more than 150 of the world's top scientists, including Nobel laureates, Dr. Kaku looks at how science will impact how we live, work, and play. He's co-founder of String Field Theory and author of 9 books, including Beyond Einstein and over 70 scientific articles. And Dr. Kaku is currently working on completing Einstein's dream of a theory of everything, a single theory to describe everything from protons, neutrons, and even DNA. Today, we're going to spend the hour with Dr. Michio Kaku, who is a theoretical physicist at the City University of New York. He is also a Pacifica radio producer with a weekly show on a number of stations around the country called Explorations. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michio
Amy,
Kaku.
I'm really glad to be here with you. It's really an honor.
Well, we're really excited to be both talking to you and debuting a segment of the 2-hour radio documentary that you have put together on this idea of visions, how science will revolutionize the 21st century. We're going to do that in the second half of the show, the documentary. But first, let's just talk. How did you originally envision visions?
Well, when I was a child growing up, you know, I used to read all that stuff about science fiction, and I used to see a lot of silliness going on. Even with my child's understanding of science, I knew that in my lifetime I was not going to have a picnic on Mars. I was not going to have a robot pick up after me. And I said to myself, why can't someone tell me what's really going to happen in the future? Not sociologists and political scientists pontificating about the next 100 years, but what about the world's top scientists telling me what their vision of the future is going to be. And that's one of the thrilling things that I'm in a position to do. I host a science radio program. I can call Nobel Prize winners on the phone, get them on the air, and have them speculate about the next 10, 20, 50 to 100 years of their research. And so this is perhaps the most authoritative book ever done on the next 100 years of science. Usually scientists are very narrow, talking about robots, talking about DNA research, aging research. This is the one book that summarizes almost all of it in one volume from the horse's mouth. And that's why it was a really thrilling thing to do because, hey, our lives, our jobs, our health, the way we view energy, our role in the universe, all of that will be influenced by this technology.
Before we move to the 21st century, I wanted to interrupt with something that is pressing right now. Actually, this past weekend, I was in Minneapolis, and I turned on CNN, and who did I see but Dr. Michio Kaku? And you were protesting the Cassini space probe that's expected to go up next Monday. And this past Sunday, you were also on 60 Minutes on this very issue. How do you connect what is happening with Cassini to this future of the world of science?
Well, as I mentioned in the book Visions, we will gradually approach the power of gods. We will have the power over life and death, and you'll hear scientists in this documentary talking about the ability to create half humans, half monsters, clones almost at will, the ability to grow organs like livers and kidneys. But of course, there's a dark side to all of this, and I think that it'd be naive if I wrote a book about the gee whiz aspect of robots in the next 100 years without telling people, hey, wait a minute, you got to smell the roses, and you got to realize that what goes up can come back down again, sometimes on people's backyards. And as you pointed out, this Monday in the morning at Cape Canaveral, NASA decided to launch 72 pounds of plutonium into outer space, which I think is a very bad idea because many physicists now, I'm not the only one, have done computer simulations of a crash with that Cassini mission. At Princeton comes a new study stating that 50,000 people could die of cancer if that thing smashes back into the Earth. My computer program, done at the City University of New York, says that perhaps 200,000 people could die if that thing aborts and smashes like a meteor from space back on the Earth. And then John Goffman, who is the co-discoverer of uranium-233, the dean of health physics, he estimated 1 million people could die in such an accident. So I say to myself, well, look, I want to see pictures of Saturn too, but Saturn's not going to go away. You know, Saturn was there for Galileo. Saturn is going to be there in the future. I say, downsize it. Wait till March 2001. The next window is going to open up. We can cut it in half and go solar. We don't have to launch the Cassini mission because it's a price you pay for technology. In other words, I'm here to try to save the space program. I love the space program. I have two chapters on the future of humans in outer space. But the only thing that could ruin that vision is if there's a backlash when the American people see that their communities are polluted with plutonium. You know, Alan Cohen, the guy who was in charge of evacuating Florida in case of an accident, he denounced the mission, 25 years a senior NASA officer. He was at a meeting, he told me, where NASA officers were looking at the plutonium go over Disney World, going over Universal Studios in an accident on launch. And something snapped in Alan Cohen. He says, look, I've been with NASA for 25 years. I'm in charge of evacuation. I can't evacuate Disney World. I can't evacuate Universal Studio. And he called the whole thing criminally insane.
We had him on the show just a few weeks ago as this has been coming to a head. Of course, people like you have been talking about Cassini for a number of years now, the idea of launching plutonium into space. But only now, with a defect, a couple of problems NASA has had with Mir and other space travel, was there a chink in the armor large enough for the media to really start looking at the complaints and the protests that you have been lodging for quite a while.
That's right. And again, I have two chapters on the future of space travel, and it's going to be fantastic. They're going to have new generations of rockets, new generations of projects, smaller, faster, cheaper, better. But you see, Cassini is a dinosaur. It's a Cold War dinosaur left over from the early 80s, 15 years in the making, bloated, unnecessary. There's a split in NASA. You know, when I was doing research for the book, I picked up a split in NASA. A lot of people don't like this mission. It's giving NASA a bad name, outdated technology. And in 1994, Dan Golden, head of NASA, wanted to cancel the project. He publicly stated to Space News Magazine in March 14, 1994, I want to cancel this mission. It's too risky, quote unquote. He compared it to putting all your eggs on a firecracker, because if it blows up, there goes $3.4 billion in smoke.
And yet it goes on. But as you say, Dr. Michio Kaku, you love the idea of space and space travel. Talk about some of your visions and the scientists you have interviewed, visions of the 21st century when it comes to space.
Well, you know, in the book and also in the radio documentary, I focus on first computers and robots. Because when I was a kid, I marveled at the idea that a robot could attain human intelligence. Well, I went to MIT's artificial intelligence laboratory. I visited their most advanced robots. And hey, people are not going to have to worry about their jobs for many a decade. However, certain jobs will become obsolete. I'm very blunt about that in the book. People should know what kinds of jobs are going to be phased out as computer power doubles every 18 months. And if you want to know about this, get a copy of the book and look under your job, and you'll see what kinds of categories of jobs are, in fact, going to become obsolete in the same way that the automobile made the horse and carriage industry obsolete, along with blacksmiths, along with horse trainers and stable keepers, but created automobile workers, okay? And the next part concerns DNA. And what was fascinating about DNA research was talking to people who are working on aging research and the ability to extend the human lifespan. That was always considered quackery and the work of charlatans. But here we are, scientists, Nobel Prize winners, in fact, now confidently predicting that we are isolating the first genes controlling the aging of cells. This is fantastic. I never thought in my lifetime we would have the secret of aging gradually being teased apart in the top laboratories around the Earth.
You have some very interesting information in your radio documentary and book by the same name, Visions, where you talk about a doctor's appointment in the 21st century. One of the scientists talks about it as you going in, they take maybe a little piece of skin, they put it into the computer, they have your complete DNA profile.
That's right. By the year 2020, I've interviewed scores of scientists who predict that there'll be this little box called the genealyzer, something about the size of a bread box. You'll put a piece of hair, skin, tissue, the inside of your mouth, saliva, into the machine. And out in a few hours will come a disk, a CD-ROM, with every single gene in your body. And this will be an owner's manual. For the first time in your life, you will have an owner's manual for your body. The doctor will read it and say, hey, look, within 10 more years, you may get diabetes. Within 15 more years, we see that cancer that is hereditary in your family coming out. And don't marry somebody with another genetic defect because you have a carrier of cystic fibrosis. And then he or she will give you a shot, but that shot won't be of antibiotics. That shot will be the correct gene. How many families have a skeleton in their closet, cystic fibrosis for Caucasians, Tay-Sachs for Jews, sickle cell anemia for African Americans? All of us have about 12 really screwed up genes in our body. And so what does it mean to have a shot where we inject the correct gene? But then seeing into the future now, the year 2040, what happens when parents can choose the characteristics of their kids? Think about that now. You can almost order kids of a certain height, a certain look, a certain strength, a certain health ability. That's the power approaching that of a god.
And soon you would be considered a negligent parent if you didn't make those selections.
Right. And then beyond 2050, because, of course, hey, you know, we're not Pollyannas, right? We're mature adults. We know the enormous implications of this. Beyond the year 2050, I have scientists stating that we will have the power to control not only the aging process, not only artificial organs like growing livers and growing kidneys to order. In fact, every single organ of your body grown in a laboratory except your brain, but also the ability to create nightmares, monsters. And I've interviewed quite a few scientists who are saying, hey, we got to stop some of this stuff. Some of this stuff will give us the ability to create half humans, half animals. And this technology has to be banned. Cloning has to be banned. But not only that, the ability to create everything out of your nightmares. And that's within a 50 to 60, 70-year time frame.
There's a part in your documentary and book where scientists discuss this possibility of cloning and cloning defective human beings. I mean, as when they cloned Dolly, there were hundreds of previous experiments of deformed sheep. But what happens when you have a little baby who you've created and who knows what exactly it will be like? The possibility of maybe not a scientific institution doing this first, but a billionaire funding some renegade scientist.
That's right. I mean, think of how many billionaires set up foundations because they have no children to which they want to give their money. Think about a billionaire who now wants to give his money to himself as a child. Okay, that billionaire may want to fund a renegade laboratory. And unlike nuclear technology, which took $1 billion just for startup money, for $10,000 and a bachelor's degree, you could set up your own cloning laboratory. That's the entry cost for this kind of powerful technology, more powerful than the atomic bomb. You don't need $1 billion infrastructure. You only need about $10,000 and a bachelor's degree. And hey, you're in business. Think about that.
Well, you have a choice if you're a billionaire that wants to keep yourself going. You could either invest in cloning a little individual like you or maybe even improving it, or you invest in prolonging life.
That's right. And like I said, scientists are now isolating the first human age genes. That was done last month, by the way. As this book was going to press, I had to mention the fact that just last month, the gene for progeria was isolated. The gene for telomerase were isolated. Two human genes that control the aging process. You might have seen pictures of progeric children. These are children that are like 10 years old, and they have the body of an 80-year-old. They're completely bald. They've lost their teeth. They hobble. They're hunched over. And they're only 10 years old, okay? That gene has been isolated now, and we can begin to control some of these age genes for the first time in history.
We're talking to Dr. Michio Kaku. We'll return with him, and then we're going to play the first part of a four-part documentary on Visions, also the title of his brand-new book, Visions, How Science Will Revolutionize the 21st Century. Dr. Michio Kaku, theoretical physicist at the City College of New York. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, here with Dr. Michio Kaku. He is a theoretical physicist at the City College of New York, co-founder of String Field Theory. He is a best-selling author. His previous book, Hyperspace, was read all over the world. His latest book is called Visions, How Science Will Revolutionize the 21st Century. Well, I said you were the co-founder of String Theory. I don't want to exactly get into it, but now we have to say something about it. You can describe it in 10 seconds, can't you?
Yes. Einstein spent the last 30 years of his life chasing after a theory of everything, a theory of protons, neutrons, a theory of black holes, a theory of the universe, a theory of DNA, and perhaps even a theory of people. And he failed. And today we think we actually have it. The leading theory, as stated by many Nobel Prize winners, is something called string theory. And it's a theory in hyperspace, 10-dimensional hyperspace. And I was in on it from the very beginning. I was quite lucky to get my doctorate degree in this area. And I founded a major branch of string theory called string field theory, whose goal is to have an equation 1 inch long you could put on your T-shirt that will explain the universe.
Now, so your real goal is to sell T-shirts?
That's right. And in fact, on PBS, they're going to be doing a series on this, and they're going to reprint my equation. They have a T-shirt with my equation on it. It is 1 inch long, expanded, and they're going to show it on national PBS television, the equation that may be the equation of the universe.
And you've already developed it.
Right. And of course, we have hundreds of scientists around the world teasing apart the mysteries. No one's smart enough to solve it, by the way. You know, the next Nobel Prizes will go to somebody who could perhaps solve all these equations. We can write them down.
But what does it mean to have a theory of everything?
A theory which would explain quarks, for example, which gives us the energy of the sun. A theory which would explain electricity, which would give us the computer revolution and light and radar and laser beams, and a theory of gravity that holds the cosmos together. And now we realize that in 10 dimensions, there's enough room in which to accommodate gravity, the nuclear force, the electromagnetic force, into a simple equation just about an inch long.
Well, I was just getting a handle on what you were describing before the break, which was children with progeria. What is it, like 2 dozen in the world today?
That's right.
Who have this disease that ages them so rapidly that they die, whatever, by the age of 10. Now, what they die of is atherosclerosis?
That's right. They die of heart attacks, believe it or not. They die of all the diseases of old age right before your eyes. It's almost like that movie Shangri-La, where they leave Shangri-La and Hollywood ages these people within a matter of seconds, right? That's actually a disease for which we've now isolated the genes. And we now know that the key to that is telomerase. Every cell has a fuse like a time bomb, and their fuses are very short, and they age very rapidly. And we now have isolated the gene that can lengthen telomerase. Now think about that, lengthening the fuses on all your time bombs called cells in your body. Now, this does not mean we're going to have the fountain of youth, but hey, we're now talking about real solid, for the very first time in history, solid clues as to what would be in the fountain of youth.
And you have scientists repeatedly saying, oh, well, yeah, sure, people are going to have a much longer lifespan. We will see people who are 150, perhaps 200 years old.
That's right. In this documentary, scientists, of course, are very cautious about their predictions. But there was so much excitement generated by the discovery of these age genes that I quote scientists saying, hey, you know, we're talking 200, 300, maybe even indefinitely.
Who
are
well.
Being able to arrest the aging process and have... as our organs grow old, be able to grow new organs to replace them.
And also you say grow, right, arms and legs.
That's right. In fact, in Scientific American, a whole blueprint was given for the artificial hand that was essentially created by your own genes and your own cells. This is the kind of technology that we're going to see in our lifetimes. And that's why in the book Visions, I wanted a book that talked not just about the obscure love life of a fish on the bottom of the ocean, but useful information, how your job, how your health, how the way you play and work are going to be affected by the science of the next 100 years, as told by the Nobel Prize winners and the directors of laboratories creating that future.
I was also very interested, Dr. Michio Kaku, in your conversation with various scientists about cancer and how, well, some people see it even today, but how it will really be seen, the technologies we use to deal with cancer, as barbaric soon.
That's right. You realize that George Washington, the founder of our country, died because he was bled to death. He bled to death because they put leeches on him and cut his veins open, thinking that's the way to do it. That's barbaric. But that's the way we will look at chemotherapy, at surgery, and radiation therapy when we look at cancer today.
Because instead...
Instead, we will go right to the genetic level. We have found the main cancer gene. It's called P53. It's on chromosome 17. We have found it. We can now manipulate P53. And we can even see the imprint of tobacco smoke on P53. If your Aunt Martha died of cigarette smoke, but the cigarette companies say, prove it, hey, we'll be able to prove that your Aunt Martha was killed by cigarettes.
But if someone has cancer today and they're listening to this and you're talking about P53, how would that change their approach to their own health?
Because right now we have several hundred trials, mainly on cancer, trying to inject the correct P53 gene to correct that misspelling in your sentence inside your cells of your body. And so far, none has been successful. But in Texas now, we have one very promising study where P53 was arrested.
Well, Dr. Michio Kaku, I want to thank you very much for joining us, but we're not finished with you, just you here, right here in the studio. We're going to turn now to your documentary, where you deal with all sorts of science in the 21st century. We're going to talk about the quantum biogenetic and, first, computer revolutions, the way they will transform the way we live in the 21st century. Dr. Michio Kaku, his new book is Visions, How Science Will Revolutionize the 21st Century, and this is the first part of his documentary.
From Pacifica Radio.
I believe that within 15 to 50 years, we will have computers as smart as people are.
The answer is your listeners have a chance to live to be 200 or 250 and stay healthy. The potential is for expanding the human lifespan indefinitely.
By the year 2050, I would expect us to be able to effectively regrow almost parts of the body to order.
Certainly at the end of the next century, I think something like half-man, half-ape-type creatures become possible.
But what is really frightening is the combination of cloning and genetic engineering, because now you have a technology that truly is frightening.
If we don't deal with the inequities in the next 5 or 10 years around the world, we may face the same kind of social collapse and economic turmoil that we faced after steam power and electricity came in.
We imagine some kind of super surgeon. I actually think of a super dexterous robot with millions of tiny fingers, which essentially excavates your nervous system.
The Earth lives in a bad neighborhood in space. We are bound to be hit sooner or later by an asteroid big enough to destroy the global civilization.
As we approach the millennium, there's intense excitement and anticipation about the fantastic scientific marvels and the dangers that await us in the future. I'm Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of nuclear physics, and this is Visions, How Science Will Revolutionize the 21st Century, based on my new book. Join us on an odyssey into computers, robots, the biotech revolution, the next generation of space travel, and the impact that these new technologies will have on our work and our lives. But first, the cyber future. Inventions have a way of changing human history. The plow accelerated the agricultural revolution, making cities and empires possible. The machine and steam engines spawned the industrial revolution, which overturned the old feudal world and gave us modern civilization. But will the computer spark the third great revolution in human history? Professor Michael Dertouzas, director of MIT's famed Laboratory for Computer Science, thinks so. His pioneering group at MIT invented much of today's computer technology.
The movement is so large that I estimate it will affect up to $9 trillion. These are today's dollars. That's half of the industrial economy within the coming century, the 21st century. And even as soon as 10 years from now, we will have half a billion interconnected computers with people behind them that are going to be affected and doing all sorts of things. The reason it's very, very hard to give in one sentence the impact is that it will affect every sector of human activity. In fact, I give a challenge to your listeners and to anyone else to find a sector of human activity which will not be affected.
At the heart of this revolution lies something called Moore's Law, which states that computer power doubles every 18 months. This means that over the past half century, computer power has increased by a staggering 10 billion times. 50 years from now, computers may be 10 billion times cheaper and more powerful than they are today. To help us grasp this pace of growth, Paul Saffo, director of the Institute for the Future, offers this startling analogy.
One way to think about Moore's Law is that if automobiles had followed the same price performance curve as Moore's Law has followed for chips, the average car today would cruise at supersonic speeds, be more comfortable than a Rolls-Royce, and be so cheap that when you parked it at a parking meter in downtown, you wouldn't put any money in the meter and just abandon the car because it would be cheaper to buy a new car.
Moore's Law means that your PC will wind up as a relic in a museum sooner than you think. Physicist Neil Gershenfeld of the MIT Media Laboratory says that in the next century, computers will be so fantastically tiny and cheap that the PC will disappear, only to be replaced by millions of invisible computers dispersed everywhere, in the walls, furniture, even our clothes and jewelry.
People ask, what's the future of the PC? And the answer is, the future is literally to be blown to bits, in that we have this indivisible notion of the PC as a display, a processor, a disk drive, a keyboard, and that's it. And the only question is how much RAM. But in fact, there are all these capabilities. Your glasses will be a display. Your shoes can have a computer. The table could be a sensor. How these connect up is adaptive and emergent and changes. You plug together pieces as you need them. We no longer have this indivisible notion of the PC. It's the computation is just really molded in with the world.
In Hollywood movies, futuristic computers are huge, monstrous devices, rooms full of sleek metal, blinking lights, and mysterious switches. But Mark Weiser of Xerox PARC, where the world's first PC was invented, believes that computers will become cheaper than scrap paper, that they will evolve until they're almost everywhere, nearly invisible and taken for granted, like electricity. It's hard to believe that a century ago in this country, electricity was so precious, there was only one light bulb per family.
We basically have one computer per person, like that one light bulb that everyone had 100 years ago or 80 years ago. But the use of electricity today is quite different. Electricity has become embedded in the walls. We go to the grocery store and pick up six packs of batteries to embed in all sorts of devices. And electricity has become ubiquitous and embedded in everything. We don't even think about it twice. And that's where we're going with computers. In a few years, we will, on the way home from work, perhaps go by the grocery store and pick up a six-pack of computers to take home because we're short of a little computing.
Not only will these invisible computers be concealed in the walls and our clothing, they will also have tiny sensors, so they will listen to our voice commands in English and even read our emotions and moods. Paul Saffo believes that these invisible sensors will be the next innovation after PCs and the Internet.
About every 10 years, a new technology comes along that really sets the information landscape and everything's done in response to it. The 80s were shaped by the advent of cheap microprocessors, and it was a processing revolution. The 90s were shaped by the advent of cheap lasers, which made all the telecommunications possible that in turn made the World Wide Web and the current version of the Internet possible. So the 90s were an access revolution made possible by cheap lasers. The next big shift is going to be the advent of cheap sensors, eyes, ears, and sensory organs that we will add to our computers and our networks. And that is going to have profound impact in the computer industry.
What would it be like to live in a world where everything around us, like the walls and the household appliances, possesses intelligence? Gershenfeld believes that these invisible sensors will know where we are, what we need, and how we feel.
In the future, for example, what I see is all day long you'll be surrounded by information processing systems, but you won't know where they are or how they work because it's their responsibility to meet their needs, not you. So for example, when you put on your shoe will have a computer, it'll be powered by your walking, and it'll use your body as a data network. So that, as a simple example, you might walk by your refrigerator, and your refrigerator has NMR that can sense your milk is turning bad, and it tells your shoes you need milk. Then when you walk by the food market, your shoes will send some data through your body up to your glasses that'll say, oh, by the way, you might want to go in and get some milk.
We're entering a world where there will be less inert matter. Today's world is things are mostly inert. They just lie there until you do something with them. You walk into a room, you assume everything is inert, unless there's maybe a power cord coming out of the back of it. In 50 years, 60 years, you'll walk into a room and you will assume that things have rudimentary intelligence built into them, unless there's evidence that they're simply inert, probably an antique from the 1980s or 1990s. So it's a world of smart effects, intelligent artifacts that are aware of what's going on around them in some rudimentary sense and able to interact in some rudimentary way with their human owners.
Some people have speculated that the future might resemble living inside a Disney cartoon. We talked to Mrs. Teapot, like in Beauty and the Beast, and Mrs. Teapot talks back to us. We might even have interesting conversations with our appliances.
Who is it?
Mrs. Potts, dear. I thought you might like a spot of tea.
But you're a...
Oh!
Careful!
This is impossible.
I know it is. But here we are.
I told you she was pretty, Mama, didn't I?
These invisible computers, hidden in our clothes and homes, will of course change our lifestyle. Professor de Tuzas of MIT believes that we will shop, just like always, except we will shop in cyberspace.
Of course, the shopping is an incredible thing. You might be shopping in Tokyo, or you might be shopping in Europe. So distance would bring all these available stores to you. And then once you're in these virtual stores, you might be trying all sorts of things. You might be trying virtually with goggles and other aids to see how the car you want to buy feels, how it drives, or perhaps it's some gardening equipment that you want to buy, you want to see it in action, or you want to play with it.
Your Thai class will have the power of a PC. You will communicate via your cufflinks, and your glasses will have tiny cameras hidden in them so you can shop vicariously by looking through your friend's glasses. This gives new meaning to the power suit.
One of the grad students at the Media Lab in this project is Steve Mann, and his body is both a TV transmitter and an internet node. He has cameras that serve as his eyes, and he's got displays in front of his eyes, but between them, he's got an RF link out to the net. Plus, he's got sensors all over his body. So, for example, you can look out through his eyes. If you go to the web page at http://www.wearcam.org, you can see what Steve is seeing right now. So when he goes to buy groceries, his wife checks to see if he's getting good fruit. Or he can see somebody else's, what they're seeing. Or he can move his eyes around. So when he rides a bike, he can look backwards. Or he can image enhance the world. He likes living with the world rotated. Or he can be a bug and only see things that move.
Visions, How Science Will Revolutionize the 21st Century. We'll be back with this documentary and Dr. Michio Kaku, physicist, author of the book by the same title, Visions, here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue the debut of the first segment of a four-part documentary by Dr. Michio Kaku. He is a theoretical physicist at City College of New York and best-selling author of the book Hyperspace. His latest book is Visions, How Science Will Revolutionize the 21st Century, accompanied by this two-hour documentary of which we are playing an excerpt, Visions.
We will still have family get-togethers in the 21st century. But instead of gathering around the rosy glow of the fireplace, family reunions will be virtual, centered around the cozy wall screen hanging in the living room.
Families could meet their loved ones over the large window wall display in the living room at night. Family might have a daughter studying in Milano, architecture, perhaps a young son at home who is getting ready to do a virtual trip down the Tana River in Kenya, and on and on. We could go on forever here.
And what about medicine? Your doctor will perform surgery in cyberspace, manipulating robot arms thousands of miles away. MIT's Dertouzos even imagines delicate surgery performed by a tiny computer circulating inside your body.
Imagine a little golf ball, which is inserted in the body and then is steered with a joystick using strong magnets on either side of the body. And perhaps it goes inside up a major intestine to an area of a suspected tumor, and it looks at it with its little mini camera. It extracts a little scoop, perhaps carves out a piece for a biopsy, or even operates the thing out, puts it inside the little golf ball, and then comes right out, and the patient is ready to go home.
According to Professor Patty Mays of the MIT Media Laboratory, in the future, everyone's invisible computer will contain what is called an intelligent agent. This agent will perform valuable functions, such as continuously monitoring the stock market, updating your schedule, helping you recall people's faces and names, and even fixing you up for a Saturday night date.
We have prototypes of a whole range of software agents. One of them is the remembrance agent, which helps you remember things. At this point, it helps you remember things related to your computer actions because it's not implemented on the wearable computer yet, but it can help you remember anything that is related to your use of the computer. We have an agent for web browsing that monitors what kind of web pages you look at and tries to figure out what kinds of interests you have, and then suggests more web pages to you or can act as your guide.
Eventually, Professor Mays envisions your agent evolving into an indispensable, constant companion, the high-tech version of a secret friend. It will be your secretary, your librarian, your helper, your advisor, even your confidant. It will know more about you than perhaps even your spouse. Life without an intelligent agent will become unimaginable.
Because your agent is always there with you and has always been there with you, you will need very little communication. It is just like, say, when you and your spouse are planning a trip or something, your spouse knows that you like a king-size bed and that you like a hotel that has an exercise room, and your spouse knows what kind of price range you want, etc. So the more intimate of a relationship you have with an agent, the less communication is necessary. There will still be some moments, of course, when you need to give the agent some information, but I'm hoping that we can minimize that so that ultimately all you need to do is wink or nod or something at your agent and it knows exactly what it is you want.
In science fiction movies, robots become so intelligent they can terrorize all of humanity. The recent stunning victory of IBM's Deep Blue computer over world chess champion Boris Kasparov has popped the critical question, can machines think? At present, the answer is no. Agents and Deep Blue cannot think any more than a handheld calculator can think. Professor Hans Moravec, director of the Carnegie Mellon Robotics Laboratory, a pioneer in artificial intelligence, explains why the dream of artificial intelligence eventually hit a brick wall, contrary to the imagination and expectations of Hollywood scriptwriters.
The problem was a little bit harder than was estimated in the 1960s. The 1960s, the researchers in artificial intelligence were flush with their first successes. There had been programs that successfully could prove geometry theorems and do intelligence test analogy problems and play checkers and chess pretty well. And these were written by the first round of students in this new field of artificial intelligence. So the estimate was that if these first problems fell that easily, how hard can the rest of the problem be? You know, another 30 years should surely be enough. Well, that hasn't turned out to be true.
In the movie 2001, Stanley Kubrick predicted that by the year 1997, a robot called HAL 9000 would be able to talk to us and run a spaceship to Jupiter.
How would you account for this discrepancy between you and the twin 9000?
Well, I don't think there is any question about it. It can only be attributable to human error. This sort of thing has cropped up before, and it has always been due to human error.
Listen, Hal, there's never been any instance at all of a computer error occurring in the 9000 series, has there?
None whatsoever, Frank. The 9000 series has a perfect operational record.
Well, of course, I know all the wonderful achievements of the 9000 series, but are you certain there's never been any case of even the most insignificant computer error?
None whatsoever, Frank. Quite honestly, I wouldn't worry myself about that.
But two things stymied this vision: pattern recognition and common sense. Robots can see, but they don't understand what they are seeing. Robots can hear, but they don't understand what they are hearing.
Things that are taken for granted in human beings that seem so easy because every human can do them are actually the harder part of the problem. These are things like looking at the world and moving around in it, and also things like common sense, which involves an enormous number of interrelated facts about the world, which in the human brain partly are hardwired in, basically are inherited from our ancestors just through evolution, and a large fraction are learned in early childhood. Well, to cut to the bottom line, the problem of those common things seems about a million times harder than the problem of proving geometry theorems.
What will be required, however, to get there is some way of programming
common sense into machines.
Dr. Daniel Kervir is an expert in artificial intelligence.
Right now, there is a classical example of a knowledge-based diagnosis machine that was programmed to diagnose skin diseases, and it was asked the question of what to do about a patient that had rust-colored spots in its skin, and they told him it was a 1978 Chevy, and he said still diagnosed measles. So you have to incorporate into the program that controls these machines a very large amount of heuristic rules that describe what we people know without even being conscious of it and enables us to function into the real world. We know the difference between a 1978 Chevy and a person, and we wouldn't think of saying that a Chevy can have measles.
Even so, Dr. Kervir points out that because of Moore's law, inevitably, robots will surpass humans in sheer brain power.
If you believe that the brain is 1,000 times faster or more powerful than our fastest computers, it's not terribly difficult to say that if you double at the rate of once every 18 months, it will take not too many years before we reach the state where our fastest and most expensive computers are just as fast as a human brain. And, well, depending on how accurate you believe Moore's law is and how powerful you believe the human brain is, you get a figure which is anywhere from 15 years to 50 years for the time it will take to reach the power of the human brain. So, yes, I believe that within 15 to 50 years, pick your choice, we will have computers as smart as people are.
Once this happens, perhaps we may see the first commercial robots with limited intelligence. Dr. Moravec even sees robot vacuum cleaners and robot chauffeurs.
It's my firm belief that within the next decade, we can actually demonstrate and perhaps field commercially robots that can be taken out of the box, put into a new environment, which will, in solid three dimensions, map the environment, enabling them to competently maneuver around and never fall down the stairs and never get lost in corners. For instance, such a system could be used in a robotic vacuum cleaner. And in fact, this looks like a market that's there because everybody wants one. There was a project in the 80s to produce for the military a vehicle that could drive autonomously on the ground. And in the 80s, the speed that was achievable was something like a slow crawl. But since then, there have been various improvements to the point where now there are vehicles that are actually driving across the country. In Carnegie Mellon, we had a robot truck that drove from Washington, D.C. to San Diego 90% of the time driving itself. There's also some vehicles in Germany that drive the autobahns. And they're not completely autonomous in that they can't be trusted with every possible situation, but they can handle the majority of cases.
First cleaning, then driving, and one day, perhaps 50 to 100 years from now, the first robots with common sense and consciousness may walk out of the laboratory. That will send shockwaves through humanity, challenging who we are in the universe. However, Dr. Douglas Hofstadter, a computer expert who won the Pulitzer Prize, is not afraid.
That's not a threat to me because I think of myself as a machine. I really do think that the events going on inside my brain are down, deep down at the base. They're chemical events. They can be looked at as quite mechanical. They're very complex, and they have many, many levels of description. So I'm not threatened by that, by the idea that a machine could be conscious, even though when it becomes such, I think that applying the word machine to it will seem a little bit antiquated and a bit silly.
Dr. Hans Moravec isn't worried about robots either, because perhaps centuries from now, we may merge with them. He envisions a day when surgeons will duplicate, neuron for neuron, every brain circuit in our skull, until our consciousness is gradually transferred into a robot's brain.
It might be possible to do this transferal of a human identity into a machine in an incremental way. So we imagine some kind of super surgeon. I actually think of a super dexterous robot with millions of tiny fingers, perhaps at the end of a branching structure that looks like a tree, which essentially excavates your nervous system, but very, very slowly, layer by layer, perhaps neuron by neuron, and replaces the parts that it removes, or even before it removes them, with an equivalent simulation, a simulation that interfaces electrically and electrochemically, but has essentially the same function as the parts that are going to be removed, perhaps even allowing the person undergoing the operation to momentarily flip back and forth between the next incremental piece of stimulation and the original neurons to see that there's no difference in how it feels. So layer by layer, the nervous system is replaced by an artificial equivalent. And this is done, as much brain surgery is, with the patient conscious. So eventually, your mind is in a machine, but your brain is gone.
But if we merge with our robot creations, are we still human? What is the difference between a human and a humanoid robot if the robot becomes conscious? Or does it even matter?
If we humans have transmitted to an artificial set of entities all of our goals, all of our values, all of our artistic drives, all of our ability to be benevolent, to care about other species and so forth, if all of that has been transmitted, who cares what it's made of? That seems to me almost totally irrelevant, what it's made of. My son is made of different atoms than me, and yet I can still love him. Does it really matter precisely what the substrate is, or does it matter that my son and my daughter are entities that are like me, that share loves of certain things, that are passionate about some things, that can be engaged by beings that love music, that love literature? Those are the things that matter to me, not what they're made of or precisely how they look or how big they are.
The day when our descendants might replace bodies of flesh with bodies of steel and silicon is still centuries away in the future.
Dr. Michio Kaku, he is the Henry Semmatt Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City University of New York, author of the national bestseller Hyperspace, and producer of the documentary you're hearing an excerpt of today, which is debuting on Democracy Now! And all over community radio, the documentary and the book called Visions: How Science Will Revolutionize the 21st Century. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear from you. And this time where we're moving into the new millennium, you can send us some email at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. But for those of you who are still in the 20th century and some stuck in the 19th, you can also write to us at Democracy Now!, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. That's Democracy Now!, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 2009. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Errol Maitland is our engineer. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. Tomorrow we look and observe. We look at and observe the 30th anniversary of the death of Che Guevara. We'll particularly look at the FBI, their files on Che Guevara. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!